This podcast was recorded over 2 weeks ago. In the last week, we have observed from a comfortable and convenient distance the complete collapse of a nation. What we have observed in the main has been a fraction of that event. We have seen anti-Assad demonstrations, people, Syrians, elated by his ousting and departure, and with good reason. We have seen jubilation in Western political arenas for a job well done, as though this was the aim all along, and whatever preceded this event was all a part of the plan. We haven't seen the relentless bombing by Israel. We haven't seen Turkey-sponsored brigades attacking communities in Aleppo and beyond. We haven't seen or heard about any of the attacks by previously denounced ISIS terrorist factions, who have now become heroes of Western policy in the region. It is far too early to yell success. It is too early also for me to yell failure. It is not too early. It is never too early to point out the obscene one-sidedness of the reporting in the press. What has happened in Syria has the potential to represent good for the people of Syria. It also has the potential to descend into what has become of Libya. And that is why this introduction to a podcast about Libya has focused so much on Syria. The circumstances may become quite similar. Do not forget that for the last few years, the USA has been stealing, yes, stealing oil from Syria via its apparatus in Iraq. 80%, by some reports, of oil production in Syria is stolen by the US. If there is to be freedom for the people of Syria, if there is to be rebuilding there of the devastation caused not only by ISIS, not only by civil war, but also by Israeli occupation forces, then will the nations that have stolen all that oil pay the bill for what they have taken, so that the rebuilding of the nation is paid for by Syrian money from its own resources? Today, Libya is a country divided. It has fallen into ruin. The national successes of building the great man-made river, among other things, have been undone. The infrastructure left to decay and destruction, the lands plundered by warlords, and the people without hope or rule of law. Whatever people may think about Muammar Gaddafi, the people of Libya did not deserve this fate. When Obama declared the need for regime change, where was the plan for the people? Where was the need the people had to fulfill their own dreams after the fall of Gaddafi? When Obama apologizes for the worst mistake of his presidency, of which there were many, in my opinion, we should also remember the lies of Bill Clinton and his inaction regarding Rwanda's genocide, when he knew what was going on and made sure nobody else did anything either. In both cases, the most powerful men on the planet were faced with situations that meant life or death to thousands and tens of thousands. They knew about it, and they did nothing. No matter how attractive or intelligent the man who comes to rob you and kill you in the night, he is still a thief and a murderer. Let us hope that the fate of the Syrians in no way resembles the fate of the Libyans or the Rwandans. Though I am not in any way comforted by the winds of fortune, in a matter of weeks, Trump reclaims his cherished seat and is hardly the person to bring peace to the Middle East. Israel, under the war criminal Netanyahu, will most probably keep going, if for no other reason than it keeps him out of his own Israeli prison cell. Turkey, under the dictator Erdogan, beloved of the West despite him having been a loose cannon for 20 years or so, wants to rebuild the Ottoman Empire. And then there are the Kurds, mistreated, abused, and hunted by the nationalist Turks, and betrayed by Trump the last time around. I remind myself, this is a podcast about Libya. It is a podcast about Gaddafi and the reasons why some people loved him and some people hated him. He was savior and terrorist. He was visionary and murderer. He was both a social democrat and a dictator. My thanks to Eshuru for his time and wisdom. Tune the mic clocking out. Enjoy.
Jepek Kuduelo Mabiro etu under Mike. Dung parodit kod jok mawo yetu under Mike. Seche tin sud buta wawinji yetu under Mike. Wala wachokre wabed piny biwawinje erochako dumomit ndi podcast makende.
I'm joined once again by the man, the activist, Eshuru. Thank you, Eshuru. How are you doing?
Thank you. Thank you. Lovely to be here once again. Yes, I'm good. Can't complain. Cold, miserable London. But yeah, all is well. All is well.
Yeah, and I'm very happy to hear that you've recovered from the latest bout of the flu. Yes. So it's good to have you back all healthy and vocal.
Yes, great to be back, really. I think being under the weather, you know, it takes a lot out of you. And then, you know, you got to kind of push the stuff aside that you want to get done, etc. But yeah, it's nice to be back and in the ring fighting.
Yep, good to have you here as well. So today we're going to talk about a country on, well, perhaps the other side of the continent of Africa. We're going to be looking at Libya. And one of the reasons why we probably had to jump into the discussion about Libya was because previously in other podcasts you've mentioned a certain Gaddafi a few times, and so therefore we kind of wanted to talk about him a little bit more as well, and we probably, this will focus mostly on Gaddafi, but there are some other parts to the Libyan story that we'll get into. But just for the purposes of an introduction, if you'd like to, yeah, just kind of let people know, if they haven't heard any of the other podcasts, what kind of references that you'd made with regards to Gaddafi and the comparisons that you'd made.
Yeah, I think Gaddafi is a very he's a very controversial character. Okay, I always like to look at him from a very positive perspective, because I always seem to compare him to, or you know, amongst the giants of Kwame Nkrumah and Thomas Sankara and Patrice Lumumba. A man that, when I say controversial, there's a lot of people who, as soon as you mention something bad, good about him, they'll tell you a negative, and they say that he was a bad bloke or a horrible person. But then you pull something else out of the bag, and you know, you get to understand a little bit about him traveling, you know, to various places around the world, and he meets all the heads of state. He meets Obama. He meets Tony Blair, and you know, you learn a little bit about what he was trying to do with Libya. He was a dictator, yes, of course, and he held on to power for a very long time, longer than necessary, some may argue. But I think that when you look at what he did with the country, where he took it from and to, you could kind of see where he was heading with it. And would it have improved under another government? Who knows? But he certainly left his mark, in my opinion.
Yep, most definitely. And it's exactly in that light, because we've spoken before about Thomas Sankara, definitely, which is one of the main points where you used to make this comparison. And it is fair to say that Gaddafi did a number of things internally for the people, for the Libyans, which could be comparable to what Thomas Sankara did. And it was in that light that you referred to him mostly. What we will obviously mention later on are some of the other things which the West would be more likely to highlight. But then again, as you said, he's a controversial figure, and so therefore a certain amount of background should be introduced. And I have to say, I have to compliment your courage yet again. It's not an easy character to associate compliments to. And I think that every politician is flawed, obviously some to a greater extent than others. But I do you know, compliment your courage in pointing out the positive sides of Gaddafi, even though we will look at the negatives as well. So yeah, but that's you. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, I think, as I said, I think that when I look at the continent itself, it's surrounded by too much negativity. And I think Africa, you know, the continent gets a bad rap, and African leaders get a bad rap, and people need to get a better understanding of who these people are, right? And let's remember that a lot of these countries lack democratic institutions. you know, they lack functioning authorities. So there are going to be problems within these countries. And again, because these countries tend to be resource rich, there is also a lot of interference from, let's say, external forces to ensure that problems persist, keep them in turmoil, so to speak, so they never really get a foothold to build anything concrete. And it's something that we witness in the Middle East and in the resource rich parts of Africa, where the leaders tend not to want to kowtow to the West.
Yep. So going back a little bit, because it was important to me also to get a bit of the background to Libya, where it was earlier in its development, where it was before independence. And this interesting story, which goes back to 1837 in Mecca, even, where the Zanussi order goes back to and the Grand right. Zanussi. And as we were speaking a bit earlier, I mentioned that in my research, I said that even until today, the certain spirituality of the Zanussi order continues within different elements of society within Libya. So this is something which goes back, it's deep, it's within the culture of the people there. What I found very interesting was between 1922 and 1951, yep. the King Idris or Emir Idris lived in exile, because this was where in 1922, Italy essentially took possession of Libya. Under a fascist government, of course, we have to remember. And then obviously there was the period of Mussolini, then the war. And then it took, after the war, it took 6 years. But Libya became the first nation to seek and achieve independence through the United Nations. I think that's also quite a significant achievement for the country.
Yes, you're right. It is actually quite an achievement. And I think this is kind of, when you look back at that, with that happening, we can kind of get a better understanding of why Colonel Gaddafi would have fell foul much later on.
Yep, definitely. And what's also interesting to point out in this period is that the French came in fresh off their own experience with having been essentially dominated by another country. And they wanted to simply take a certain region called the Fezzan from Libya and simply occupy it themselves. Without any kind of consideration for what the Libyans may perhaps want to do themselves. The Italians wanted to keep Tripolitania, as it was called. And so we very much have, even after the war, even after the experiences of some of these European countries, the way that they wanted to essentially expand their tentacles, the control over any areas that they could, which they were aware of, obviously, that Libya had certain resources and certain things that they could benefit from. And that's all they cared about.
Yeah. But this is the mind of the colonial settler powers, right? I mean, they never put the local or indigenous populations thoughts first. You know, it's purely for selfish reasons.
But within that particular atmosphere, as we said, we had King Idris.
Yes, Idris.
Yeah. So from 1951 until 1969, very much pro-Western.
Yes.
And this is an individual who, when he took over, in 1951. We talk about Libya that had been ravished by the war. It had 40% mortality rate, 94% illiteracy rate.
Yep.
So, this is a lot worse than Burkina Faso was, if you remember when we talked about the situation that was there. So when you have such a severely bad situation, there's also the possibility for a steep improvement of that nation. We didn't necessarily see that.
Later on it came, but at that particular moment, no. What I understand, what I've learned to understand about the world is simply this. A lot of the colonial powers, whenever they enter a country or enter a region, it is said, you know, again, this is one of the revisionist ways of looking at it, that they improve upon what was there before, as if these people needed improving in some way. But what you often found is some places were actually worse off as a result of having colonial powers there, because the quality of life diminishes somewhat, because the only purpose that these colonial powers have is to control the country for its resources and nothing else. It doesn't care about the people.
And unfortunately, this is one of those situations which essentially led towards in 1969 the famous bloodless coup. Libya had been very much a close ally of the West. There were army bases or military bases of the United States and the UK in Libya. Libya had received more than $100 million in aid from the US by 1959, which made it per capita more than any other country. So clearly there was quite a close relationship between King Idris and the West. And coming at a time when there were heightened, shall we say, conflicts between Israel and other Arab nations, this pro-Western perspective was problematic for the Libyan people.
Well, let's take a look, right? Problematic in the sense that let's look at it from a personal view. You come into my home and you give me build a little area in the kitchen for yourself to make food, right? And then I decide, but I'm going to take, you know, some of the spoils out of your house for myself. I mean, of course, it doesn't sit well with the people of the country, right? So they may have some level of order and less chaos, but does it benefit the people as a whole? And history is dotted with these experiences or these different instances where the West have gone into many different countries, were in the countries. I mean, Iran is another example of that. Very pro-West, West-friendly, but the West was only there for the oil, and the people themselves weren't really benefiting as a result. And it's a very similar situation to Libya.
Yeah. And so therefore, as I said, there was the bloodless coup, and into this vacuum, shall we say, stepped deliberately very much Mr. Colonel Gaddafi. And Gaddafi brought with him this vision of hope. He was this very young, handsome gentleman, powerful, confident, and promising of reforms, promising of improvements, promising a significant change for the people of Libya.
100% correct. Yes, he, young, good-looking, dashing, yes, full of promise. He manages to seize power in the country through a coup. You say it was bloodless. And he ran the country for, say, probably the best part of a decade before the problems really started for him.
Yeah. I mean, one of the first things that he did was he removed British and US military bases. This was practically the year after. This was in 1970.
Correct.
He also expelled, now this was an interesting chapter to read. He expelled Italian and Jewish community members in 1970. Now, we have to remember, obviously, Libya was occupied by, or it was a colonial possession of Italy. And there were significant anti-Israeli sentiments within the nation because of what had happened with regards to Palestine. So he took this position and expelled Italian and Jewish community members in 1970. In 73, and this is something which kind of reminded me of Mossadegh, he nationalized foreign-owned petroleum assets in the country. And that, I think, is quite significant. And this is perhaps one of the reasons why I believe you and other people would say, well, look, he wasn't all bad.
It's what he done once he nationalized these assets. And of course, let's remember, him doing that would have pissed off the Americans and the British, right? That we know for sure, okay? There's absolutely no getting away from that. But let's also remember that the money wasn't used purely to enrich himself. Yeah. Long story short, he took the literacy rate and the infant mortality rate from where they were, 40% and 94%, to one of the most successful on the continent of Africa, one of the most wealthiest, right? So he didn't just enrich himself. And I mean, there's scores of things that you've read about what he's done over the time that he was in office. I mean, education and medical treatment, for example, was free in Libya. I mean, a whole host of countries where it's free. It's not free in the US, and it certainly won't be free in the UK very soon. So, yeah.
Yeah, indeed. And as you say, he also, what was interesting was that He's not. He's against communism because he wanted to introduce Islamic law into Libya, and so therefore he wasn't somebody who was going to embrace communism, which is very much an atheist political ideology. So he wanted to create this a Libyan Arab Republic under a motto of freedom, socialism, but also introducing his own interpretation of Islam. And this is quite interesting as well to read, because other Islamic countries didn't really appreciate his interpretation of Islam. So he was very happy to rattle some people who perhaps we would have thought that he wasn't going to nerve or annoy, but he did so.
Very much so, very much so. I think that whether it was intentional or not, we don't know. But we do know, for example, how he and the Sankara didn't really see eye to eye, as we discussed in a previous episode. So, there are these things that we know about Gaddafi. But I think I said in one of the previous episodes that Gaddafi himself, the man was a visionary, okay, and he was way ahead of his time, because as we said in the beginning, Sankara didn't like him. But then, if you look at their work and where they were pretty much aligned on the same page by the end of their tenure in their respective countries.
I have to say, when I was watching and I was trying to find different perspectives of Gaddafi, I couldn't actually find one which presented a particularly positive ending to his rule. We will come to that later on, because I'm very hopeful that you will present that argument, because I couldn't find that, unfortunately. I tried very hard. I couldn't find that particular side. But I do remember seeing and reading a lot about how, and we'll come to this as well, but you know, how he introduced direct democracy within Libya, because this is one of in his green book, this was one of the things that he wanted to do. So what he wanted to create was a unification in some ways of these different principles. So on the one hand, social democracy, socialism, and on the other hand, the principles of freedom, but also the Islamic traditions as he saw them. And he did this with the structures that he created within Libya.
Well, he did travel around the globe. As I said earlier, you know, you saw, you know, as much as he spoke about him as being this tyrant, etc., he met with heads of states and obviously traveled to the UN. He'd say his piece. But what I've later learned with him, that he was actually traveling and looking at different democracies, Britain, America, etc., because he wanted to implement, you say, a direct democracy. That was his idea. And this is all outlined in his book, The Green Book, as I said. And I think that he was ready to move the country into another direction. Now, how that looked, I don't know, because it was never discussed, and I'm not sure if there were any of his children that were being primed for taking over, or if they were just going to hand over the reins, you know, back to the people. I have no idea. But he spent decades studying different democracies and wanted to implement something very similar into Libya, and the direct democracy was his preferred option. And this was after traveling and speaking to scholars and heads of states and studying various democracies around the globe and how they function and how they benefited the people within those countries.
Yeah, I'm very happy you mentioned that, because this was something which I'd taken note of, but unfortunately I really have to improve my note keeping, because I've written pages and pages of stuff, and now when I want to find them, I can't find them. He really did not like representative democracy. And I have to say, as much as I have found about Gaddafi, which I didn't like, I can't disagree with this. I also find representative democracy, in the way that it is today in most Western democracies, to be a system which doesn't actually deliver. There are many important decisions taken on behalf of the people in Western democracies that I believe they simply would not really want to authorize themselves. And this is one of the problems when you don't have political parties of any particular or distinction. If we look at the UK, for example, if you ask most people, or if you ask people to do to respond to a referendum about significant changes to the National Health Service, most people would say, no, we want it to go back to the way that it was. However, these options are not presented to them. And this is why I think Gaddafi was right in this sense to say that representative democracies simply do not do what they should.
100% agreement. I think that we need more direct approach, because I think that politics has to evolve. Political systems have to evolve and change with the times. Okay, that's first of all. When I look at Britain, Britain has a first-past-the-post system, representative democracy, but it doesn't represent all the people all the time. It is problematic. There are too many cogs. Some of the cogs are going in different directions, and this is what causes stops and bottlenecks. With a more direct approach, you're dealing with the people directly. You're moving the intermediaries out. People really get a chance to voice their opinion. One of the problems with representative democracy, they don't always take up the questions that you yourself are interested in. Yes, you could be left-leaning and voted for two or three left-leaning parties in Germany, for example. Here it's just the one. Well, you can kind of say one. But they don't necessarily take up or bring forth the questions that you want them to talk about. And that can be problematic. You can sit and think to yourself, well, why did I vote for these people? Because they're not even looking out for my interests anyway. Whereas when you got a direct democracy, you have an opportunity to have your voice heard. It depends on more people participation. That's the difference.
This is something which has been an issue which I really dislike, because most people that live in democracies think the act of voting every 4 or 5 years, depending on a system, is participation. And for me, that's not participation. That's the bare minimum anybody should do. Real active participation in a democracy means making sure the people who represent you are doing their jobs. And the fact that in the UK, we can see people like the representative for Clacton, I won't mention any names, who never does any bloody town halls, is not there to answer questions of his constituents. Correct. And I think that is a pure abdication of his responsibilities. And we see it too often.
Yeah, and England's a great example, right? Because England likes to brag about having the mother of parliaments. I don't know how they managed to get that label here for some strange reason. But if you look at the political system both Britain and America have, they're both two-party countries. I mean, how can a country of almost 70 million and a country of what, over 350 million only have two parties representing the voice of the people? Surely there are more diverse opinions, right? So the point I'm trying to make is that when the world evolves and people evolve, and we're going through an information age now, and the legacy media is no longer a fit for purpose, so people are getting the news from social media, political systems also have to change, right? And we're still using a political system that has been in operation for over 100 years, you know, 150 years. It's time for change. People need something else. The problem is the way the system works currently, both here in the US, it benefits the sitting party to keep the system the way it is. It's up to the sitting party to make the change.
Yep.
And therein lies the problem.
Yeah, which they in the US, at least, they are never able to do so, because it's required a certain percentage, which is almost unreachable based upon the system of elections that they have with the Electoral College as well. The one thing that I have, which is I completely disagree with what happened, at least with regards to Colonel Gaddafi, was that he was one of those, and you said that he's a dictator, and he was. Even though, which is, here was quite funny, because on the one hand, he wants to introduce direct democracy, but on the other hand, he continued to be a dictator. So obviously this contradiction was quite stark. But reading what committee groups that he introduced, so he wanted local committees. These were called People's Congresses. There was a basic People's Congress, and which were many thereof. And then these would be brought together with the Jamahariya, which was called the General People's Congress. The problem that I have with this was that at the end of the day, though, he decided. He decided what happened. It was his group of generals or whoever that would essentially dictate what the results were, what the conversation was. This direct democracy was allowed to exist as a structure, but not as an operational body.
And that's the problem. I think that's, and this is where the problem is. I think you still need, at the end of the day, if you're going to have a direct democracy, you still have to have a full decision-making process where once the questions or people's opinions are being taken into account, how then are these passed into, and all these guidelines used? What should really, it should not have been in generals. It should have really been representatives picked by the people to represent. This is what should have happened. So you got Gaddafi at the top, and then let's say you have the representatives of the peoples, and then you got the peoples here. And these people then, you know, work in the interest of, and that's where it should have been. And then it would have been more accurate instead of having his generals who ultimately work for him.
And it seems that he's very much a person who wanted to be loved. The problem that these kinds of people have is that they find it very difficult to accept criticism. And this is one of the chapters which I found particularly distasteful. And let me quickly try to find the year. So on April 7th, 1976, students carried out mass demonstrations against the corruption of his regime. And they demanded the election of a civilian government. Arrests were made. However, a year later, so 1977, students were executed. And the thing is, this exercise continued every year until the 1980s. And for me, we've seen it recently where with American students demonstrating against the genocide in Palestine. We saw the way they were treated by the American government and police forces there. We thought that was absolutely horrific. But this is obviously a different level. Horrible.
Yeah, and this, I think this, and this is a side of Colonel Gaddafi that we don't hear much about, right? It is horrific that people went this way, and I have really no arguments against it. There's nothing I can say because I don't agree with those methods. It's horrendous. That's all I can say simply about that.
I mean, you and I, we very much are people who we love the youth. The young people are the future of every society.
Yep.
They need to be supported, they need to be protected, they need to be encouraged.
Correct.
To voice political opinions, even if those opinions are against what we think to be correct, because that is what young people should do.
Yeah, 100%. They need to push the boundaries because they're in a different phase in their lives than where we are, and they're seeing things in a very different way. They are the future. And many of us in the age that we're at, we're not coming to an end of our lives by no means, but we see the world in a very different way. So the young people should be not only pushing the boundary, but they should also be given, you know, taken more seriously, in my opinion. You know, their counsel should be sought after, certainly when it comes to political questions. And it's one of the things that, you know, certainly seeing Britain through the whole Brexit lens. The people that got screwed the most out of all of this, or let down, I should say, probably a better word, were the young. The majority of the voters were quite old, and this is not I'm not being ageist here. I just want to just get that out there for our elder listeners. But here in Britain, I think the numbers were something like 75% of the people that voted were over pension age. And you know, I think they voted for their reasons, but then I think a lot of them never gave the consideration for the young people who are coming up, their grandchildren and great grandchildren after.
And this is one of the reasons why I think a lot of young people will look in the near future, I hope, to push for another referendum, and hopefully there'll be a different result there. But anyway, that's a different conversation, which I'm sure we'll have when the time comes.
Sure.
Yeah, so now that I've been so severely critical of Gaddafi, and I will be critical again later on, but in 1984, he begins a project called the Great Man-Made River, which I think you are the first person to have told me about this. And so therefore, I think you're really supportive. You really enjoyed this project, didn't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the Man-Made River, I think they call it the eighth wonder of the world, I believe. That was kind of the nickname that it was given. Now, Libya, North Africa, is a very arid place. Everybody knows that, okay? And what what Gaddafi had found was a huge aquifer of sweet water, fresh water, underground. And he decided that the people who were in the towns or villages that had wells would be able to get access to water directly to where they were living. Now, I can't say for certain if the water was delivered to their houses or if the water was delivered to villages or in abundance. But what he'd done was he decided to embark on a project to tap into the aquifer, which meant drilling down, tapping into the aquifer, and then drawing the water out. Now, he was approached by, I'm not sure if it was the IMF or the World Bank, but he was approached by one of these institutions. As we know, they're both headquarters in the US. And he was approached, and he thought to borrow the money, or part borrow the money, in order for him to be able to fulfill his request. And he says no. He says that we have money from all revenues, and we can use our own money without any problems. Anyway, he was asked a second time, and he refused. And he used his own money, tapped into the aquifer, and he was able to build what they call the man-made river, man-made lake, and he's able to run water from the aquifer to every town and village around Libya. This had never been achieved before. It was a huge project, and it was done successfully with their own money from the oil reserves. Okay, very wealthy country.
Yeah, it was the world's biggest irrigation project, which is what it's referred to. And something which people should also remember, and this is something that you also mentioned later on, when we talk about humanitarian considerations, in the first civil war, the first Libyan civil war, the man-made river was unfortunately bombed. It was hit by NATO forces. Investigations were conducted. The investigations came back and said, yeah, there was evidence that weapons had been stored there and so on, but not enough evidence was gathered to be able to make a final determination as to whether or not it was this or that or the other. Okay, we've heard all this crap before.
Yeah.
It seems quite clear that NATO forces targeted it because they wanted to put pressure on the Libyan government, and that's exactly what happened.
Well, standard thing, right? The first thing to do is always affect the people. And once the people are disgruntled, then it's easier to overthrow the government. The same thing that we saw in Iraq, right? As soon as they got rid of Saddam Hussein, what would people have to ration? Water and electricity. They only had water so many hours a day and so much electricity. I mean, the infrastructure was there for it to run all the time, but they use it as a weapon to get people upset and disgruntled. And it's a very similar thing here. They went straight for the source of water. And then, of course, dipped water in to give people water to drink. It's ludicrous.
Yeah. Some people perhaps don't really know why the West is so anti-Gaddafi, because let's face it, they don't really care if he executes innocent students in his own country, because, yeah, these are nations that have done far worse in their own past. What they didn't like, however, was the way that Gaddafi embraced political, or I should say, in some cases, brutal terrorist organizations, what the West labeled terrorist organizations, what Gaddafi considered to be liberation organizations. He embraced, he trained, he funded, he supported the IRA, yep, ETA, and the Rote Armee Faction, or the Red Army Brigade, in Germany. Who were obviously, as we know, responsible for any number of terrorist attacks in European cities and nations. So one way that you're guaranteed to piss off governments is to support the people who are blowing up their citizens.
Well, you know, what we need to look at is this. We need to take it back a bit. You know, one man's terrorist, another man's freedom fighter, right? And I reject, sometimes I take offense to the word terrorist in these instances. I'm not saying what these guys did, ETA, IRA, Red Faction, the ANC, I'm not saying what these guys did was great or good or positive. But here we have imperial forces, Britain, America, etc., who use their might to control people in regions that are far away from theirs, just because they want to control what they have. Of course, people are going to get upset and fight back. it's as if they want you to be able to be happy in your punishment and not get up and fight back, right? As soon as you defend yourself, they call you a terrorist for defending. I mean, Britain and America and allied nations, they drop bombs relentlessly on regions all over the globe. They have done since the end of the Second World War. But people just supposed to take it? Or are they supposed to fight back? There's always going to be collateral damage, always. And I think if you have that understanding of the world, we understand why terrorist incidents happen. And we should just stop calling them terrorist incidents. I think that, we should really call them, blowback for European misadventures and US misadventures in various regions.
Yep. There is a lot to that argument. You are absolutely correct to say that what some people would consider to be terrorists, other people would consider to be freedom fighters. This has always been the case throughout history. It will always be the case throughout history. The people today that are looking at what's happening in Gaza, whenever we talk about the genocide there, the automatic response is always, yeah, but they need to root out Hamas. But the entire population of Gaza is not Hamas. No. You cannot justify killing thousands upon thousands upon thousands of innocent people just because you want to go after a certain organization.
Let's have a look at the history. You know, why was Hamas created? Why was Al-Qaeda created? ISIS, ETA, IRA? Let's have a look. Why? Understand why they were created in the first place. They didn't just appear. They are there as a result of something. If we get to the root of that, then we can have a better understanding of why these people are fighting. But I think one of the biggest problems we have is in Western, not folklore, but the way the West tells a story, always tells a story from somewhere in the middle. It never starts at the beginning. And this is how they get people. Look what's happening in Palestine. For some reason, they seem to think it started October the 7th. But you can tell them the troubles have been happening for the last 75 years, right? And when people say, but yeah, Hamas had control of Palestine for 15 years, the Israelis backed off. No, but you controlled the land, the air, and the sea all around Palestine, and you control what went in and what went out. It was still an occupation, my friend. It just wasn't an occupation by name.
Politically speaking, unfortunately, all of these words are used to try to dictate the political fallout, the PR, the way that the image that it represents. I mean, this is something which also goes all the way back to the East India Company, where they used to write reports back saying that yeah, we are civilizing the savages here, whereas in reality they were not savages. We are talking about an extremely philosophical old culture, a number of old cultures within the region. But obviously, the East India Company wanted to continue to garner support from the people back home. So therefore, these were the reports that came out. And it's the exact same thing that we're seeing today with this thing. It's easy to call people terrorists, especially when you see innocent people dying. But then that means to not look at the innocent people that are dying, where those people come from.
Well, absolutely. I think that they use derogatory terms for them to justify what it is they're doing. That's the problem, right? And the way that the story is told, it's told from the standpoint that we are always the good guys and we're always doing good. Thankfully, the world, and hopefully people will remember what we've witnessed over the last 12 months. People's eyes must be open now and realize that, hold on, maybe we are not the good guys, that we are supporting, the death of children. I think sometimes I look at what's happening over there and wonder if it's just there seems to be an excuse being used that we're targeting these people because I hide amongst civilian populations. But don't all terrorists live amongst civilian populations anyway? So you got to make your precision strikes a little bit more targeted, as opposed to aiming for an entire block to look for one person.
And also, just because, so I mentioned the IRA, ETA, and the Rote Armee Fraktion, I'm not going to permit myself to make any kind of opinion on these three organizations because I don't know enough about the history. I definitely don't want to get involved about the debates of Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland in the UK. Yep. I don't know enough about it. Neither do I know enough about ETA, nor do I know enough about what the Rote Armee Fraktion. It was just a question that these were three of the organizations within my research, which I discovered that Gaddafi had supported. And obviously this pissed off a lot of the Western countries. So this is one of the reasons why they wanted to go in and take him out, I guess.
That's right. 100% correct.
Yeah. On top of that, what I found to be pretty interesting is that he wanted to initially introduce Pan-Arabism, I think that was the term, but that didn't work out. Later on, he changed tack and he went into Pan-Africanism. And he put his money where his mouth was. He invested significantly initially. I think one third of the entire budget that was created in a certain year was presented by Libya. That's a serious amount of cash. He wanted to improve infrastructure. He wanted to improve education. He wanted to improve, I believe, food production. He wanted to make a lot of African nations basically self-sufficient, independent, and he wanted to make sure they did not go cap in hand to international banking institutions that you referred to earlier.
You know, the North Africa is a bit of a interesting place. The French and the basically the Europeans, and you will hear some people say this, they have spent, or they spent many decades convincing the North Africans that they were similar to Europeans because of their skin shade, that they were different from sub-Saharan Africa. But let's remember, we used to call Libya, Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria, we used to call that North Africa, but now it's referred to as the Middle East. And if you look at the maps, the maps start there and goes across in the Middle East, although it's a part of the continent of Africa. So the name has changed. It's like the Europeans and allied nations have decided to remove it from Africa. And this is what something that Gaddafi was always adamant about. He says that we may have lighter shade skins, but he goes, we're all Africans. He says, don't allow yourself to be, or your mind to be corrupted into believing that we're any different from our brothers and sisters in sub-Saharan Africa. And one of the things he wanted to do was unite the continent, something that Europeans didn't want. Because again, when I say Europeans, I'm talking about the West. They're good at divide and conquer. And again, when you look at the map today, you look at the Middle East, you'll see African nations, and then you'll see Saudi Arabia, and then the rest of the Middle East as the Middle East. Which is what he wanted to get away from, because he believed that if we can join forces together, we're becoming stronger as a continent. And he believed that Africa, and I 100% agree with him, Africa didn't need the world. The world needs Africa, something he saw and understood. And these are dangerous things to be spreading across the continent of Africa, especially to the very wealthy established families and big businesses that want to access African resources at the prices that they're getting for now to remain profitable in the world.
Yeah. What's also interesting, and it has absolutely nothing to do directly with Muammar Gaddafi or Libya, but when I was listening to the autobiography of Malcolm X, he went on an 18-week trip. He wanted to go to Mecca, but then on the way back, he visited a certain number of African nations, and he kind of started his journey, I believe, in Egypt as well. And it was during that trip where, because he essentially, he observed some of these people almost as white people.
Yes.
In his book. And he said at the time that that trip turned his opinion, because before that he never thought it was possible to be genuinely on good terms or friends, or expect good things, expect acceptance, accept friendship, genuine friendship from a white person. But he said after that trip, this opinion of his changed. And what you have just pointed out, between that period of time and now, an extensive process has occurred of creating division between those communities, because he always said he could not believe how he was embraced as a man, as a person, by those nations. So what's happened since then?
I think that we went through a period where people globally from various different countries started to find each other through their struggles. We started to ally ourselves with struggles. This of course is a problem. It's problematic for the establishment. They don't want people joining forces and being together. I mean, I just use Brexit as a prime example, right? Brexit has it has trapped the majority of people on this island, so they can't leave and walk freely amongst their European brothers and sisters. But those with the wealth are able to be able to walk freely, you know, so they've trapped the majority. But if you're allowed to, and a very similar thing with the rest of the world, where people are able to, we're able to connect and move together, they've started dividing us, because we have definitely gone through a shift over the last, not even 10 years, it's the last 5 years, when I look at the rise of the far right, how it has been allowed to rise very slowly in the background. They now occupy corridors of, you know, they walk and occupy top positions in the corridors of power, business, finance, politics, you name it, media. And that is favored over you and I connecting, because we have a similar struggle 3,000 miles apart. And yeah, one can speculate why and who and all the stuff in the shadows, but it's clear to see that this that is being favored.
So going back then to Gaddafi, towards the final years, there were certain portions, at least, of the Libyan people who were turned away from him, the corruption that they saw. He did become quite a difficult person to understand, very flamboyant in the way that he dressed, yep. and the way that he communicated. Yep. Some would perhaps say arrogant. It kind of coincided a bit, I think, with the Arab Spring. There was this sudden rejuvenation. People wanted to seek change. Now, I'm hoping that you are much more informed than I am. Was there perhaps also a certain degree of foreign influence with regards to the way that Gaddafi essentially was considered by different portions of his people?
They were blamed for a bombing in West Berlin back in 1986. So it wasn't without its troubles. And then there was a flight that blew up over
Lockerbie,
Scotland, in 1988. A bomb exploded in a French airliner over Niger. Six Libyans were convicted for that. And again, I think that we had the trial of Lockerbie in 2001. Libya, I think that, of course, they went through a series of sanctions after that point. And then slowly things started to kind of, you know, warm up again after all these problems, because I think Gaddafi, you know, after you, I think 2003, the UN Security Council, they voted unanimously to lift the sanctions imposed on him after 92. And then there was a thawing of relations. So he meets, Tony Blair in 2004. He meets Berlusconi. He meets Condoleezza Rice. He meets Obama. And things, you know, start to slowly thaw. And I think that it was around, well, just before that time, the Arab Spring happened, or just after, rather, the Arab Spring. And I think that people had enough of, you know, these brutal regimes. But at the same time, I believe there was an unseen hand in there to ensure that whoever left office and came into office would continue to take care of Western interests, okay? And I think that in terms of Gaddafi, I don't think that after his the thawing out and good relations, I don't think the West entirely trusted him as a result. And this is when things started to go sour again for him.
In the same way that we see Iraq today, in the same way that we see to a great extent Syria, even though we've spoken about this, but in the same way that we see today in Syria as well, after Gaddafi was killed, the country has fallen apart. And so for me, when I hear this word regime change, when I hear this policy of saying we need to bring peace to the people, we need to bring democracy to the people, that's not what happened. Let's also look at Afghanistan. Look at the situation now for the people in Afghanistan. Look at the situation that the women are now having to face every day by the brutal regime of the Taliban, when they're not even allowed to speak public position. This kind of stuff for me is horrific. And
Libya, it's not that far. It's absolute chaos. Warlords rule everywhere.
Yeah, it's a failed state. And the thing is with Libya, you'll not hear the Americans or the British talk about Libya in a positive, in a way that would let you know that they had something to do with the change in the country. That's the problem. You've heard the stories about all these young black men who are escaping sub-Saharan Africa, they're ending up in slave markets in Libya and being sold to highest bidders on the slave blocks, as it was, you know, 150, 200 years ago. These are the stories that you hear coming out of Libya. All the oil and the gold that the country had has been stolen. I think the banks had to, the banking system was something that we never spoke about very briefly, that they were not aligned to any Western banking system. And this was something that they reversed as soon as they got into the country and changed it to make them aligned with Western banking system. So, you know, the country was taken over and completely destroyed. And it's a very similar thing with Afghanistan. And, you know, it really begs, you know, brings a question, what's the West has gone somewhere and leave, you know, do they improve on a place or is it worse? You know, we can argue till the cows come home, but the evidence is there for many of us to see that Libya is not in a better way today than under Gaddafi.
Yeah, definitely. When we undertook this series on talking about the post-war, post-colonial African nations journey that they have taken until now, we decided that we wanted to ensure that we would look at it through positive eyes, that we would look at these situations and we would talk about what they're actually trying to build rather than only focusing on the tragedies of the histories that occurred before then. Unfortunately, when we look at Libya, we cannot see that positivity, because that any kind of positivity that the country could have had, should have had, with the wealth that they invested in themselves, was completely taken away from them. Yeah. I would say Gaddafi had a big role to play in that. But on top of that, I would say that all the Western countries that refuse to allow pan-Africanism to develop with its own funding necessitated the downfall of Gaddafi.
100%. Definitely can't disagree with a word of that. And this, I think this is one of the problems, one of the challenges for Africa in the future. I spend a lot of time on X, what was formerly Twitter, talking to a lot of people who tend to be right-wing in their opinion and bigoted. And, you know, one of the things that keeps coming up, a reoccurring question is, why can't African countries take care of their own? And you even hear some black people say, we need to stop blaming the West for Africa's problems. But when you have some nations in Africa that do exactly what the West wants of them, and they're left alone and they're funded, receive aid, etc., etc., and then when you have African nations that decide and want to do things for themselves, this is when the problems start. Now, Mali, I read this morning, have made some more moves in getting rid of the French, Burkina Faso, Niger. These are countries that are really pushing the boundaries and saying, you know what, no more. But attempts are being made on the lives of some of the leaders of these countries already, all of them being unsuccessful, thank goodness. But I can only hope that the rest of the continent takes something from what these guys are trying to do in these countries and realize that Africa doesn't need the world. They can do everything for themselves. They can feed themselves. They can develop for themselves, and stop allowing the more influential nations to decide your internal policies. They did that in 1884 at the Berlin Conference. It's brought you where you are today. You're not in a good place for it. Look forward and work together to build for yourselves. That's the only way Africa will get ahead.
On that note, thank you very much, Eshuru, once again for your insight and your time. And I look forward to the next one.
Thank you for having me.
And Mike. And Mike.